us.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's appeal to moderates has alienated some of those in the right wing of the Republican Party. Here, at the state party convention in San Jose, we've been asking if that tension will affect next November's election.
Just like any family, you don't agree on 100% of everything, and we're ironing out the small differences.
In an unannounced conference staged outside the press room, some of the party's conservative members spoke out against Schwarzenegger.
The Republican governor should simply be appointing qualified Republican judges who are going to enforce the death penalty and protect the community.
Stephen Frank is a conservative activist. He says Arnold doesn't have the support of the average party member.
The overwhelming majority of the party believes in the laws of economics, opposes minimum wage increases, wants a balanced budget, don't want bonded indebtedness, want more Republican judges. That's the vast majority of the delegates here and the Republican base.
But as soon as conservative leaders had finished addressing the media, Arnold's supporters raised their voices in his defense.
And while I know that we may not agree on every single issue, I hope that you know that I have your family's best interest in my heart.
Republican Kay Young thinks Arnold's shift is just a sign of the times.
The Republican Party is logical. I think we're moving, all of us, towards the left. But the Republicans move a little slower, and I think that's better.
Some say the governor helped ease tension in his party when he joined forces with the conservative candidate for lieutenant governor, Tom McClintock.
Let us also remember Reagan's wise words that anyone who's with you 80% of the time is your 80% friend, not your 20% enemy.
But right-wingers still aren't happy. They're threatening to sit this election out.
They just stay home.
All he has to do is provide a GOP agenda for the Republicans, so we have a reason to be energetic in our efforts for him.
The governor's challenge now is to get both moderates and conservatives behind him.
At the end of this convention and at the end of the primaries, the party will be 100% unified behind our election team, and I expect that they'll win in November.
With no opponent in the primary, the governor can focus his efforts on the general election. For CNS News, this is Joelle Jaffe reporting from San Jose.
Can a person be pro-choice, pro-environment, socially moderate, and fiscally conservative? Some students we met in San Jose say yes.
People don't like that super conservatism, and it doesn't work for California.
The Republican Youth Majority is a national network of progressive young people who want to broaden the party.
I think if there were four or five or six different Republican kinds of youth groups, we'd be a much stronger party on college campuses.
Washington lobbyist Roman Bueller helped start the group in 1995 and is its biggest donor.
We've had people over the years who've contributed quite a lot of money because they believe that the Republican Party needs our kind of voice.
But not all young Republicans agree. The college Republicans are a powerful force on the UC Berkeley campus. They've been approached by Bueller's group, but aren't interested in joining forces.
I think that there should be requirements of certain ideological beliefs. You shouldn't have to be pro-choice or pro-environment to be in a group that you want to be Republican in.
For many, Republican Youth Majority is too far left.
I feel passionate about, you know, guns, taxes, trade. I just kind of want the government to leave me alone. Abortion's not a big issue with me.
If these groups are any indication, the GOP of the future may be just as divided as today's party. For CNS News, this is Lindsay Gill.
Good to see you.
State Controller Steve Wesley says he's running a different kind of campaign for governor.
Because when I commit to something,
I want to make it happen.
In recent weeks, he's traveled to unlikely campaign stops such as Chico, Eureka, and Bakersfield.
Too many people who run for office spend their whole lives in Sacramento, and I think it's important for me to get out to the smaller, medium-sized cities.
On Monday, the former eBay executive took his roadshow to Santa Barbara for a full day on the campaign trail. He had lunch with local officials and then visited Santa Barbara City College, where he pitched his plan to make community college free for all Californians.
Any student completes a two-year degree, the transfers to a four-year school, the state of California ought to provide free community college.
After a quick consultation with campaign staff,
lunch was very good, but it was, every answer was a speech.
Yeah.
This was, your conversations are engaging.
It was off to the next event. A field poll last week said 54% of likely Democratic primary voters are still undecided between Wesley and his opponent, State Treasurer Phil Angelides. But voters will soon learn more as both candidates launched statewide television campaigns last week.
Phil Angelides, endorsed by California's teachers.
On Tuesday, Angelides came to the UC Berkeley campus to debut his new commercial. Although he currently holds a small lead over Wesley in the polls, Angelides is ready for a tough primary battle.
I want to be governor of the state of California. It's not going to be handed to me. I want to be the nominee of our party. I've got to make the case to voters. And if I can't win the primary, I can't win the general.
But some wonder if either Democrat has enough charisma to challenge Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in November.
I don't think Californians want a movie star to be governor, per se. But the fact is this, neither one of us are that well known.
Democratic voters will decide which candidate has a better chance to reclaim the governor's office on June 6th. For CNS News, this is Joshua Fisher in Santa Barbara.
More than 1,000 miles of levees, embankments built all along the delta to keep it from overflowing, are now so fragile that the governor recently declared a state of emergency.
I think it is very important that I am a governor that creates the action and I don't wait around for a disaster to happen.
The governor's statement is what levee experts like Jeff Mount have been waiting for decades.
In the last 50 years, although we've known there's a problem, no one's figured out what to do about it.
Some of the areas that are notable.
Even within the state administration, for years they've feared a disaster.
I don't think the people who are knowledgeable of Delta issues and Delta levees would be surprised if it happened tomorrow.
The problem is this. The levees were built mostly by hand more than 100 years ago to create farmlands. The foundation is sand and loose dirt called peat soil. And even under the best conditions, improvements consist of only heavy rock along the levee's edge.
It's just a band-aid until you can get the money to come back in and actually fix it.
Now the islands are sinking up to 20 feet below sea level, increasing the pressure on the levees. All it would take is a heavy rainstorm, a minor earthquake, or even just rodents digging their way through as they did it on the Jones Tract levees in the summer of 2004. Major infrastructure and our drinking water are at stake.
You end up basically drawing salt water from the bay into the delta, and salt water is not what you want to send people to drink.
There are plenty of billion-dollar solution ideas on the table. A cheaper one is restoring some of the islands as wetlands. But that idea seems almost impossible with more than 100,000 new homes in development right now.
Talk about recreating New Orleans all over again. And the development interests are so powerful. No politician is willing to step up and take them on.
The governor plans to spend about $100 million for short-term repairs. But the health of the levees is just part of an even bigger story affecting millions of Californians. For CNS News, I'm Julie Christensen.
Today, more than two-thirds of California's water comes from the Sacramento Delta. Once a vast, unmanaged marshland, the delta has been transformed by levees and concrete into a maze of canals that pump water to farms and towns across California.
We're right here, Stockton, California.
Local fishermen like Whitey Rasmussen know that the delta's water supply is dependent upon a complex ecosystem.
Got him. There he is. Look at him.
Last year, scientists discovered that a tiny fish, the Delta smelt, was vanishing.
In a sense, Delta smelt really are the miner's canary that are signaling the health of an entire estuary.
The decline caught the attention of Congressman Richard Pombo. Pombo is the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and over the last 10 years, he's made it his mission to roll back the Endangered Species Act. This past week, the congressman asked state agencies to explain why the smelt are disappearing.
It's pretty clear that it's complicated, and it depends a lot on a lot of small hydrological details.
Agency scientists did not offer a lot of answers. And while that frustrated some, Pombo found the panel's uncertainty perfectly reasonable.
They came in and said, we don't know yet. And to make any kind of a major policy change at this point would be premature.
This panel was designed to give you the minimal amount of response that they could get out of the room with.
And with no policy changes in sight, the state can continue pumping water south unabated. And that's precisely the problem, says local farmer Mike Robinson.
We're just taking too much water out of this system year-round.
But blaming the Delta's problems on water exports is dangerous.
It's probably close to political suicide.
Local Congressman George Miller agrees.
All I know is there's a considerable lobby to look everywhere but the pumps. You know, you can look to Mars for this solution, but you can't look to the pumps. You can look.
Last week's hearings brought no answers. But at a time when just mentioning cuts in pumping is political suicide, some say that even a simple hearing is progress. For CNS News, this is Jordan DeBrie.
For as long as folks can remember in Stockton, California, water was essentially free, paid for by a small public utility fee. These days, water is pricey, profitable, and privatized. 3 years ago, the Stockton City Council signed a 20-year, $600 million deal with OMI Thames, a global conglomerate that manages water plants around the world. The Sierra Club sued, arguing that the contract violated environmental law. In April, the San Joaquin Superior Court will rule on the lawsuit.
They have not fulfilled the contract.
Dale Stocking is group chair of the local club.
In our analysis of what's happened over the last 2 years, they are not saving us money.
In some California towns, outsourcing has led to rate increases, the very outcome Stockton's vice mayor hoped to avoid in signing a contract with OMI.
And the contract itself has some guarantees regarding how quickly rates can rise. The old way, if there were shortfalls in their budget, they'd come and ask the city council. They were short. They're short, we say, that's too bad. Figure it out.
In January, however, the city didn't tell OMI to go figure it out. They approved new fees, fees that could go to OMI for new water projects. But because Stockton's growing, OMI and the utility department say the costs are unavoidable.
It really doesn't make a difference whether the city would continue to operate it on our own behalf or the company. Either party is going to have increased costs due to growth.
The city and OMI argue that the contract did not change how the water system is repaired and maintained, so there should be no need for a new environmental review. Still, citizen groups argue it is a slippery slope outsourcing a major part of a water utility.
This is why we have municipal utilities. This is why, you know, citizens band together to provide things that individually they can't provide for themselves.
No matter what happens in April, appeals may keep the case in courts for years to come.
In Stockton, this is Nick Goroff with CNS News.
San Francisco is home to over 80,000 immigrants. New to the country, they are often easy targets for con artists.
And few of these scam artists are ever caught. But Dr. Stephen B. Turner is the exception. Arrested 3 weeks ago, he faces 131 felony counts, from practicing medicine without a license to battery and cruelty.
In an exclusive interview with Dr. Turner, he talked to me about those crimes.
I drew blood. And I administered sterile saline solution that they thought was a vaccination. and immunization. You know, I take responsibility for this. And again, I want everyone to know that I did not hurt anyone. No one has been hurt.
But Arnoldo Garcia, an immigration advocate, says harm was done.
Unfortunately, what happens, right, is that it might be the only time they go to a doctor. So if they're getting scammed, it's like a really big injustice, you know. If they have some kind of treatment they need, where else is it going to be cut?
The medical exam is required for INS paperwork and costs $200.
Un examencito de sangre, que es para vivir acá legalmente.
Sí, claro que sí. No, no es para sí, es para los papeles.
Well, I asked them if they had any medical problems, and I would just record the medical problems that they don't have.
And so if they didn't admit to any?
I would check off everything. It's been fine.
In our interview, Dr. Turner implicated an accomplice, Sammy Bajil, the director of the clinic.
Sammy collected the money from the immigrants and gave me half.
Why would he do this?
Because he wanted to make money too.
We're going to try and get into this clinic and see if the director will talk to me. He's been avoiding my calls.
Sammy is also an immigration attorney, although I could not find him listed by the California Bar Association.
Sagrario speaking.
Quiero hablar con Sammy, por favor.
Okay. Jale la puerta para que suba al segundo piso, okay? Gracias.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm so sorry. I didn't know. I'm like...
I mean, what he did is... It's very typical, this case, someone posing as a doctor. Other times it's landlords, employers, store clerks, gas station attendants, police, people who should know better than an authority.
The district attorney estimates that Turner may have examined up to 14,000 people, but many of them may never come forward.
So in this case of the doctor, right, they're a victim of a crime, and they're afraid to, they'll either ashamed or afraid to step forward, or both.
Luckily, Dr. Turner was caught, faces a hearing on March 16th in San Francisco. But he is one of many still out there taking advantage of this very vulnerable group. For CNS News, this is Tony De Aslan.
I'm Nick Goroff here on the campus of University of California, Berkeley. This May, the first class of undocumented students will graduate since passage of AB 540, a bill that allowed undocumented students to attend California public schools for in-state tuition.
Steven, who asked not to be identified on camera, is one of these seniors. He came from Mexico with his parents 13 years ago. AB 540 gave him a shot at college.
And at the time AB 540 came through, it was definitely my opportunity, and I knew that, you know, as soon as it passed, I was already making plans. I definitely did not see myself as a salesperson for the rest of my life.
Though AB 540 students may save as much as $17,000 a year over non-residents, paying the bills is still a challenge. Undocumented students can't get financial aid, and most fellowships require citizenship. Stephen works three jobs.
And then after that, I'm taking 13 units at Berkeley. And then usually on weekends, I go over to my house because I still help support my parents.
According to the UC President's office, there may be as many as 400 undocumented students currently in the UC system.
But I think the alienation that they're feeling is a big one in the sense of, I would say, feeling scared, feeling not know who to trust.
Gallegos Diaz, a UC staff person, recently started up a support group for undocumented students.
So I help every student that comes through my door.
Federal legislation called the DREAM Act can make life easier for undocumented students, but it has been pending for years. At a recent forum, Nicholas Espiritu explained how it could be their pathway to citizenship.
So this is an opportunity for individuals who have gone to college, who are going to be the next, you know, generation of skilled workers that this country produces, for them to be here legally.
Until the DREAM Act passes, undocumented graduates will still face a hard time. Their college education doesn't provide them with a work visa, a social security number, or a driver's license. Stephen, however, is undeterred.
I'm undocumented and I graduated with a BA, but to me that's not enough to make my statement, like, I want to get a PhD.
And that, says Stephen, would be pretty cool.
I'm Nick Goroff in Berkeley for CNS News.
This is a familiar greeting at Farmacia Remedios. It's more than just a pharmacy. It's a pay-as-you-go, no-appointment-needed clinic, and the first stop for healthcare for many in the Bay Area's Latino community.
Luis, an undocumented worker from Mexico, walked in with a high fever and a sore throat.
Swallow for me. Swallow.
Sé llegar al hospital, pero no sé cómo me tratarían allá, porque no tengo Social Security, no tengo green card, y me costaría más.
Getting access to healthcare can be difficult for many new immigrants, especially the undocumented. Last year, 80 bills across 20 states sought to bar non-citizens from public health services or require benefits agencies to notify authorities about undocumented applicants. Latinos are the hardest hit of this group. Only about 1 in 3 are insured. Charles Briggs has been conducting a survey on how Latinos learn about available health services and how they navigate the American healthcare system. While some fare well, Briggs says, others are left disappointed.
They feel denigrated in health situations and feel that they often return to Mexico if there's any serious health problem.
Rather than return home, Ben Singer has brought Mexico to his customers.
People come in here and say, smells like Mexico.
It's more than just the scent of home. Everyone here speaks Spanish, the shelves are stocked with familiar brands from Mexico, and the hours are flexible.
In the Hispanic community, most of the people that work are either day laborers or work by the hour, which means if you want to go see a doctor, you have to take the day off work, which means you don't get paid.
Word is spreading quickly. Just 2 months after its opening, Singer's Mission Street location has seen over 500 patients, including Luis.
No he ido al doctor nunca. Siempre con pastillas se me quita. Pero hoy sí necesito el doctor.
Singer says he will open 20 more pharmacies over the next 5 years. For CNS News, I'm Catriona Stewart. Every filmmaker dreams of. A nod of approval from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
The death of Kevin Carter, casualty of...
Dan Krause made his first documentary as a graduate student at UC Berkeley. His thesis film was one of four nominated in the short documentary category of the 78th Annual Academy Awards.
It's the ultimate vindication of your work being worthwhile.
I think he was a little surprised at how taken people were with the film.
Dan worked as a still news photographer before making a documentary about another one, Kevin Carter. He was a white South African working during apartheid. Dan chronicles Carter's life and eventual suicide, focusing on the turmoil that swirled around his Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph of this Sudanese girl in the midst of a famine.
I really did empathize with Kevin as someone who was very enamored with the idea of making great photographs, even though he knew it was emotionally destructive.
2 years after Dan finished the 27-minute film, his name appeared as an official nominee. Television and radio stations booked him for interviews to hear more about Kevin Carter's life.
He was committed to it because he knew that these pictures could make a difference.
And then finally, the moment everyone was waiting for.
And the Oscar goes to... A note of triumph, the golden age.
No Oscar for Dan, but he says the experience wasn't about the gold statuette.
I'm going to look back at it as being one of the most enjoyable, exciting experiences of my life. It's so far from where this all started.
The question for Dan now is where will his success take him? This is Sasha Woodruff for CNS News.
Ever pay attention to that long list of credits at the end of a movie?
You basically just stop looking at them after the first 5 lines.
To cities, each line in the credits represents a job.
The gaffers, the grips, the electrics, the prop masters, greenskeepers, special effects guys, 16,000 people strong in the Bay Area. That's a lot of people making their living in the industry.
Robert Fujioka over here, Alan Steinberg.
You think about it, we had about 20 days of film shoots in 2003. Last year we had 133. We have seen a 500% increase.
Mayor Gavin Newsom hopes to spend $350,000 to promote San Francisco as a production hub. But when they come, will they stay? In order to attract and keep the film sector here, the Bay Area needs to be able to provide for that industry, everything from pre-production through distribution.
the way to have a really robust industry is to have everything from soup to nuts.
In Oakland, that soup to nuts facility is exactly what the city wants to develop. The Wayans brothers have a deal with the city that allows them exclusive rights to propose development at Oakland's old Army base.
What they're looking to do is to create on 70 acres of land in the Oakland Army base a combination full-length film production and television center.
If all parties don't reach an agreement in 12 months, the studio deal could fall through.
And so we haven't had a major studio since the Great Depression in the Bay Area, and this will be the first one, and that's why it's absolutely wonderful.
Supporters hope the deal will transform the film industry into a major part of the local economy. We'll have to see if this one makes it or ends up on the cutting room floor. In Berkeley, this is Pamela Harris for CNS News.
In 2005, Americans may have noticed a new trend at their local theaters. Gay-themed films like Brokeback Mountain are now getting top billing. Along with Transamerica and Capote, all are attracting mainstream audiences, and the lead actors, all straight, were nominated for Academy Awards.
We definitely at a new place. I mean, Brokeback Mountain has definitely crashed through a ceiling.
In the heart of the Castro District, Rob Epstein runs Telling Pictures. According to his 1996 documentary, The Celluloid Closet, gay images have been in movies, well, since they were invented. But in 78 years of often poking fun at gay people, has the Academy ever awarded an openly gay actor?
No, there is not an openly gay actor that's ever won an Academy Award.
Is that a problem?
Documentary filmmakers, but no actors.
Epstein should know. He's won two Oscars for documentaries which brought gay issues to the forefront. Shouldn't gay actors also be able to find issue in the lack of statues on their shelves?
A gay actor who has that kind of talent and that kind of belief in themselves and that kind of strength, the rest will come.
Larry Friedlander sees it differently. The Stanford professor and Shakespearean actor thinks Hollywood isn't really about acting at all.
They're really more like an escort service. You know, Hollywood, they're giving you, they're packaging a fantasy for you. And so a romantic comedy starring an acknowledged gay actor playing a straight man runs into real difficulties.
Friedlander maintains that Brokeback Mountain was an important event for gay people. And he doesn't mind straight actors being cast as gay men because that's part of acting.
I was more puzzled and dismayed by the publicity and all the stories about how hard it was for Ledger and what is his name to kiss. And that seems quite insulting and also so unrealistic about actors. You know, Rock Hudson made love to many beautiful women, and he didn't have a story saying how he had to pretend that he was kissing Montgomery Clift when he was kissing Elizabeth Taylor.
A little bit.
There certainly isn't a shortage of gay actors and performers. A visit to one of the Castro's mini drag shows will prove that. But how do these aspiring stars feel about no gay actors getting to kiss Heath Ledger, portray Capote, or fight Reese Witherspoon for the Oscar?
I'm not annoyed because I think that they were played all very sensitively and played all very real, if in a real way. And I mean, who really would be better for those roles? Who better than Felicity Huffman? I can't really think of any better casting for that part.
There may not be equal casting opportunity in Hollywood, but here at Harvey's, it's a different story. This drag queen, Holy McGrail, was the surprise of the night. It turns out, like Felicity Huffman, she's not a man at all, but a woman.
And that's a sign of, I think, progress with drag. Just like we're talking about progress within the movie industry. It's not really about what you have down there, but what you do once you get on stage. And I think drag should move with the change with the times, just like everything else.
Here in the Castro, it seems to be talent, more than orientation, that wins awards. Hopefully Hollywood and the Academy will soon get with the times. In San Francisco, this is Jason Blaylock for CNS News.
I'm only wearing a cowboy hat because it was raining and I had it in the back of my car from Halloween.
I'm Pamela Harris, and in this story, birds are chirping, so we'll wait.
Big...